In each Masters of Beautiful Achievements Academy episode, Alexander Prinsen interviews guests about how solutions inspired by nature can provide sustainable opportunities for our future challenges. Since 2013, he is globally researching sustainable business models and innovations. To share his findings, he founded the Masters of Beautiful Achievements Academy. Welcome to this edition of the Masters of Beautiful Achievements series. In this session, I'll be talking with Anders Nyquist about education, creativity in relation to the circularity of our economy. Anders is an architect whose inspiration by nature has motivated him to create creative, purposeful buildings and projects. He calls this eco-cycle design. His clients are all over the world, and he calls his home Sweden. Anders, it's an honor to have you in this session.
I'm happy to be here.
Since we met in 2014, you planted a very important seed inside of my brain. And that was about the need to provide sustainable perspective for change agents all over the world on our future challenges. Could you share with us why this is so important for you?
I think it's a question of survival for the humanity on the globe. If we can't understand how to live together with nature, I think it's impossible to survive in the future. For there are so many problems we have to solve together on the globe. And the whole humanity need to work together and work together with nature, in balance with nature, otherwise we haven't a future.
And why is the balance with nature so important? Because you also have people who are saying we're already living in balance with nature.
Yeah, but we are not living in balance with nature. The Western way of building cities is not sustainable. I think it's time to reflect about how the way is to reach a sustainable future in the built cities, but also in the new cities. Mm-hmm. So, for example, in Africa today, there are 1.2 billion people living. Mm-hmm. And within 25 to 30 years, it will be 2.4 billion people living in Africa.
So that's two times more.
Yeah. And it means that during 20 or 30 years, we need to build 601 million cities in Africa.
In 20 years?
In 20 to 30 years to meet that the demand from the African people. And if we are still building them in the Western way, there is not possible for a survival. For you know already in South Africa, the lack of water. They have very little water and they are using the same Western wastewater treatment systems that we have done for 150 years, and they are not sustainable. So we need to think over the way how we shall plan our cities. And we must plan them so we have enough of food, we have enough of relations to other people, and to feel that we are living safe. And we are not doing that with the planning methods we are using today.
Now, I remember reading reports that cities are actually one big heat absorbing spatial area. The heat doesn't get away from the cities, it concentrates the heat.
Yeah.
So like a concrete, cities are becoming one big desert. Where there is no life, less green. And I even read a report that the oxygen on top of cities, the oxygen levels are lower now than 20 years ago. So if I understand these scientific reports, then the need to change becomes drastic.
Yeah, and I think my vision for future cities in Africa or all over the world is what we can call ruralization. Instead of urbanization. Now we are always talking about urbanization, bigger cities, higher for more and more people. But I think if you are thinking in a totally different way with city planning, it's possible to build a city for 40,000 people in an area of 2 by 2 kilometers in one story buildings. And it means that in the northern part of Europe, you need about 10 by 10 kilometers to be totally self-sufficient with food, energy, water, wastewater treatment and building material and so on. So this is something we had to change our mindset mm-hmm. about planning cities. So if you have a small city with 40 inhabitants, then you have all the service you need. It's on walking distance between all the, what you need for the daily life, and it's self-sufficient with food. And this is so important. And now we are discussing how can we educate the coming generations to solve this way of living, to have another standard for living. So I'm working together with people on El Hierro, the small island in the Canary Islands, where we are planning a new type of universities for young people who want to be self-sufficient and live a better life and change the total mindset for living. And this is so interesting. For in the future, also well-educated children will see that it's not so much job on the market. For the automatization of a lot of productions means that fewer people are involved in the creating new jobs. But the need of the simple things is the need of food, need of water, need of shelter, and need of energy. If you can manage to find solutions for that, then you can live a happy life in the future. Don't work so much.
Most people would love to do that.
Yeah, and I have tried it during 25 years when we were living all year round in our village, in the Rumpan village in, outside Sundsvall in Sweden.
And what is special about Rumpan village?
It's what you call an eco village. I don't use that name, but for be very short, I say it's an eco village. Mm-hmm. We started it, my wife and I, and some relatives. We started it 50 years ago.
50 years ago.
Oh, before we had all the beautiful words as sustainability and closing the loops and all. Mm-hmm. So we wrote a program based on a social vision. Mm-hmm. The social vision was based of the same way of living as I have seen when I grew up in a fisherman's village outside the coastline of Sweden, where everybody was individual, but we need to survive on an island all year around. You need to cooperate with all the other people when you need help. And this was the basic idea for our village. But we also wrote down that we wanted to live in balance with nature, what we call ecological buildings or villages nowadays. And we also have a vision for the technical solution. Mm-hmm. We wanted to figure out what is the best available technology in the world that we can implement in our village. And it should also be made of local material. And it should also have a low yearly cost. The economy, together with the other things, must be also affordable for normal people. So our village, it's 25 families living together. And it's built by amateurs. No professionals have built it. So I train people and they trained each other. And now we have a village for more than 100 people living together. And there we also have had our office. And the office is also EcoCycle adapted.
So basically what you were just saying is creating an eco-village between brackets, because everybody thinks about eco-village, people with long beards, hippies.
Yeah.
Your village is completely different.
Yeah. No, it's normal people who want to live in a safe and sustainable way. So we have our own water supply. We have our only wastewater treatment. we can get the energy from the forest, from the firewood. We have a windmill in the neighborhood of the village producing electricity. And we have farmland so we can survive, we can grow our own food. And we have the ocean with a lot of fish. So if my grandchildren have problem in the future, they can move to that place and they can survive by just use the resources we have locally. This is blue economy when it's best.
What is blue economy?
Blue economy is to use the resources you have close to the place where you are living. And in a blue economy society, there are no waste products. In nature, there is no waste.
Yeah, that's something I've been sharing with my listeners for a long time already.
Yeah, so when a tree are dry and fall off in the nature, yeah, it's a starting point for a new life. It's not garbage or waste or whatever we normally call it in the Western
world. Yeah.
So this is very, very simple. And when we started to run our own business, my wife and I, mm-hmm, we moved out to the countryside to the small summer house, and we added some more room for us, and we built the office. And then we also decided that it's possible to live in a totally different way. Mm-hmm. I had been managing director for a consultant company in Sweden with 100 employees, and my salary was very good. And my wife have a state a job for the state and was also well paid. And we said, in the rest of our life, we shall half our income from what we had earlier, and we shall only work half time. We wanted to be free during the summers, and we could be together with our children and our grandchildren. This is so important in that part of my life. So we tried to do that, and my wife, she had a very good control of the cost for the family, for we have been married for a very long time. And we saw that it was three parts of our economy that took all the money. It was the house,
yeah,
it was the car, and the food.
Always the car in there. Yeah.
So if we lower the cost for these three parts, mm-hmm, then we can live a simpler life. And we could prove it by trying it ourselves. And we made a calculation model. Mm-hmm. We call it a time cost calculation. You can calculate how many hours do you need to work with an income, and see how you are using that income for these three parts, for the house, for the car, and for the food. And we had the office 10 meters from our home, so it's on walking distance.
Sounds very beautiful.
And we use the car when we have to go to clients, and the clients paid for me, yeah, to go to the client. And then there was very low cost for the car. And then we produced half of our food ourselves. We were fishing, we were growing vegetables. We have a greenhouse, yeah, in front of our office, so we can produce food also in wintertime.
Yeah, it makes me wonder, how tough is it to transition the way you've done with your wife and family?
Pardon?
How difficult is it? Because most people say you cannot transition.
It's easy. Decide. Have a goal, mm-hmm, for your way of living. I think that's so important. So sometimes when I've been educating students at the university in Sweden, I said one of the things that they have to do is to write down, sit down for first of all, and dream. What kind of life do you want to have in the future? Where are you really want to live? Where are you, the way of living? What kind of work do you want to do? What kind of friends? And also, yeah, the total life. Think it so you can see it for your inner eyes.
Interesting. I'm teaching now also, mm-hmm, and
These are really tough questions for the younger generation.
Yes, but I think it's time to reflect about what kind of life. Is it a commercial, old-fashioned way to live?
Mm-hmm.
More income, the better you are. And you, the more money you have when you die, you're happy you perhaps can be. But this is a totally different way of thinking.
And what are you experiencing from the feedback from your students?
The feedback from the students are sometimes very, very interesting. So I tell them that they shall see it for the inner eyes and then go to their table and write down the story about themselves in the future. And I think this is the starting point on a very, very interesting journey to the future. So if you have a clear vision,
mm-hmm.
where to go, then you have a direction. And if you haven't a direction, then you are walking around in the cities, shopping. So that's not life. Life is something totally different.
Mm-hmm.
That's the social vision for your own relations to other people, to your family or whatever, to nature, to whatever you do. And I think if we go back, I've been working as an excavator and architect for archaeological excavations. We were digging out a Bronze Age city in Cyprus, and I was thinking about what's the life in a city on the Bronze Age with 10,000 inhabitants.
Yeah, which is so much smaller than we do now.
Yeah, it's a big city, and this was a big city close to Larnaca in Cyprus, and they live in balance with nature. For they have the energy, they have the building material. They were using clay bricks, mud bricks for building the houses and the wooden stuff that they can find in the surroundings. And they have the food, they have the energy, everything. And very interesting, how many hours do you think they are working to get food, clothes, whatever they need for their daily life?
Knowing you, Anders, that would be half that we're doing now. But I can imagine a lot of people would say it's very high because you're constantly working the whole day to get your basic needs.
4 hours.
4 hours
Four
a day.
4 hours a day for a grown-up to get the food, to have the built the houses. And then they have 20 hours to be social with their friends. What a fantastic life. If you think about a normal European family, as you are two young persons, you are living in a suburb to a big city. It takes you at least 1 hour to get to the job. Then you are working 4 hours. Then you have 1 hour lunch. Then you are working 4 hours. And then you have at least 1 hour more to come back. How many hours are the working day for you? 11 hours, perhaps 12 hours. And if you live close to the place and work close to the place where you are living, you are saving time. Time that you can be using for other things. So I can't understand why we choose to live in suburbs to big cities and spoil our life. Commuting and do nothing. Look at the roads in Holland. One person in one car, three lines in both directions.
Completely full, yes. We have huge traffic jams in the mornings and the
afternoons. Yes. So I make another choice.
Yeah.
I left a small city, moved to the countryside where I was more or less self-sufficient. And then I could do the job I really wanted to do. I could say no to a job that was not exciting enough.
Mm-hmm.
And we said that we should only work with green projects, if you call it green projects, in Sweden and all over the world. And we are happy that we are looking back now that this was possible for us.
So a drastic change is possible, but it's important that you have a vision in which direction
you need a vision.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you have no direction.
Yeah, I know. There's an interesting saying from Alice in Wonderland. when she's at a cross point and she asked one of these images in the movie, which direction should I take? And the question was, where do you want to go to? Mm-hmm. I don't know. Then both choices are good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So if you don't, but it's hard for a lot of people to know what they want, because it's not what we've been taught.
Yeah, and there's another thing I used to tell my children and my grandchildren, that from my own experience, take the train when it's coming. When you are standing on the platform and it's coming a train, take the train. Don't ask, where are you going? What's the end station? But if you have a chance to do something exciting, do it when you have the possibility. Next day, perhaps the it's laid down or you haven't the chance again. So this is also something that it's very difficult for people to change when they have established on a site. Then they have it's very difficult to make a change. We have, my family, we have always think about that.
Mm-hmm.
Take the chance now. You never know if it's a chance in the future.
Yeah, that reminds me of, what was it, the movie, like, you never know what kind of chocolate you're going to get from the box.
Mm-hmm.
So it was interesting. Looking back to your projects, Anders, when I researched it and you explained to me when I was in Sweden, it feels that there is the common sense you just described in the transition you made.
Mm-hmm.
And you've been integrating various systems in your architectural mm-hmm. project. What is the connection to eco-cycle design and how does it fit into the bigger picture?
I think first of all, when we are making a new project, we educate all those who are involved in a project. From the decision makers on the top level, all the way to those who are handling the project. And then also the workmen working on the site. Everybody who are involved in our project must have a background, so we speak the same language. The next step for us is to write a program together with the client. And then we do it in the client's knees. So we move to the place where they are going to build the buildings or planning the cities. And then we are discussing, first of all, the social vision for the project, the kind of life that you are offering in your project. Mm-hmm. If it's a one-family house, I must know if I should design the building the way the family is living. And it's also, if it's a commercial building or if it's a block of flats or whatever, you must have an idea, a vision for what kind of life do you think you will offer within that building. And my job is to make the shell mm-hmm. around the social vision. And then we are talking also about, in the program, about the ecological vision. And this is to figure out how can we design a building with less footprints in nature. And then the technology, the technical vision. Where can we find the best available technology in the world? And then I'm working together with the CERI organization, Zero Emission and Research Institute, together with Günther Pauli. And I can drop an email to him and say, I have this problem. Where can we find the best solution for that problem? And then within 24 hours, I've been connected with a man in Madagascar or whatever, wherever. And so we can together solve the problem. And this is, we are working with open sources. It means that we can tell other people our experience from mm-hmm. what we have done, the good things and the bad things. So this is so important. And then when we are talking about the technical vision, we talk about the economical vision. And the economical vision is not only the investment cost. It's more or less the most important thing is the yearly cost or the life cycle cost.
Mm-hmm.
And we know from our project that they perhaps are 10% more expensive than ordinary buildings.
Yeah.
But already the first year, we can guarantee that it's at least 10% cheaper, the running cost. But the society today gives a gold medal for those who are building the cheapest houses. And the cheapest houses is not only, always the cheapest, the lowest running cost. So this is the way that we start. And then in combination with very important calculations for the site, we must know about the site and mm-hmm. also the local culture. If we are working in a totally different country, you must know the local culture, otherwise you can't design a building in that environment, and the local climate, and yeah, all the technical information you can get from the site. So this is the start. So most of the architects, they start when they get the project, they start designing the building. And it's impossible to design a building if you don't can look upon the social vision, ecological vision, the technical vision, the economical vision. So we are, when we are starting to design a building, we are sitting together with our clients across a table, and I make the small sketches, and then we can decide. So we are not using computer-aided design. We are using our brains and our pencil.
And here comes common sense around the corner.
Yeah, yes.
Yeah, and it's interesting. I've at least in the Netherlands, where I'm living at the moment, there is a huge debate and dialogue on retrofitting the built environment.
Mm-hmm.
And it, interesting enough, what you mentioned, Anders, is that everybody tends to go for the lowest cost, but everybody forgets the running cost.
And mm-hmm.
what I've understood is that they're both different budgets.
Mm.
So the one who's procuring or building the house, they invest in the bricks, but they don't care about the running cost, which I explained them from a systemic point of view, how you could design a building also from the inspiration you gave me. Mm. And they look at me like, yeah, I know you're right, but we work differently.
Yes. And I meet also that comments. And I think that's to retrofit the built society is very, very important. And I think it's possible. It's possible to do it, but you must think it in a totally way, to rethink it and try to figure out what's the best for the life cycle cost and for the total total idea about the house.
Yeah, and then what to do with the stuff you take out. Of course, you need to put that back into a circle.
Yeah.
And interesting, the way you're talking about architecture, and basically before you start, you teach to make sure that everybody speaks a common language, which is an interesting approach.
And also the worksmen on the site,
mm-hmm.
which is also very important. We know that from some of the projects that they can't read my specification in drawings. It's sometimes made in a different way than they are used to do.
Mm-hmm.
But if I explain that you have to do it in that way, otherwise we will have humidity in the walls or whatever it could be. So this is so important.
Do you reckon that the common sense in the workforce is much higher than those who are being your let's say your contractors or your clients?
No. When I explain this way of working, they understand that this is important.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And they are, and from the managing point of view, this is saving money.
Yeah.
It goes faster and people are happier. It's cleaner on the workplace and so on. So we know that it's working.
So basically you're showing the cash, and when they see the cash, then you say, okay, Anders, go ahead, we want this.
Yeah.
It's interesting because that debate tends to still be in the current paradigm, what I'm used to when I'm advising companies, and once you want to transition them to the new paradigm, there's a lot of teaching to be done.
Because
they find it very hard to see the whole system within the part.
But we need good examples, and that's the best way to convince people. And that's, we are happy that we have so many projects that we can show our new clients and say, we did it in that project, and it we have positive or negative result from the project, but we can show them that it is possible to do it. So we need good examples.
Yeah, and I know you have a really nice example in the northern of Sweden with the
Green Zone. Yeah,
yeah, Green Zone.
Yeah.
Can you share a little bit on that? What makes it unique?
It was built 20 years ago.
So this
year we have a 20 years anniversary, and we will have a seminar in September
celebrating it.
And I met a client who wanted the best available technology in the world.
Okay.
And this was the starting point. He had never built a house before.
he had a vision.
He had a vision. And he was running a car dealership.
Mm-hmm.
And he wanted to build a block where he can assemble some of the buildings with connection to the car industry, not production cars, but to serve, give service for the cars,
mm-hmm.
but also fast food. It's a McDonald's in the block, and there is a petrol station. And these three buildings, a shop with mechanics and everything what they need, they are the three worst polluters in the wastewater treatment system in the municipality. We have no connection to the wastewater treatment system.
They're off the grid.
Off grid, yeah. And they are self-sufficient with energy. For the McDonald's restaurant, we have a heat exchanger for the restaurant, and they are producing so much energy that we can heat all the buildings in the block. We can also heat 5,000 square meter more if we have more buildings in the surroundings. From the kitchen in the McDonald's.
And this is 20 years ago.
20 years ago. And this is the only McDonald's in the world. There are 25,000 McDonald's in the world. And this is the only McDonald's selling hamburgers and energy. And the same for the petrol station. They have a lot of freezers and fridge and so on that needs a lot of energy. And we also take care of that energy. And we can store it in the ground by boreholes. So during the summers, we are storing it in the boreholes, and we can reuse it in the winter. So they are self-sufficient with energy.
Mm-hmm.
And the stormwater, we are taking care. Stormwater is a big problem in cities, but we are taking care of all the stormwater. We have used the best available building material. And we know from
in Swedish?
Yeah, doctors of handling, right? Doctors thesis. It was a lady who she made a calculation for the project. It was 17% more expensive than if you compare it with an ordinary building. And it was 10% cheaper the first year. And now we know that it's still cheaper. And another thing very important, this is the own the car dealer in Sweden that has less sick leave. So the people in the building are much healthier. And in the building, we, for example, use living plants as a part of the ventilation. We have termite ventilation for the intake of the air. And that's very simple things. It's all, again, common sense. If you use the best available technology, it's must be better for the building and for the people who are working in the building.
I have just a question. What do you do with you said they were also off the grid for their water.
Yeah.
How are you cleaning that?
We have an infiltration for the gray water.
Okay.
On the land. And then we take care of, we have vacuum toilets, so there is very little water, less than 1 liter per yeah. flushing. And this is the only thing that is not working, for this was something that the municipality should take care of, for they wanted to make energy from the black water.
Yeah, and what is black water?
Yeah, from the toilets.
Okay, yeah.
So, but this was the only thing that was not working from the very beginning. And this was what the municipality should do.
And make a biodigester
yeah,
out of it.
Yeah, this was the idea.
So that it could have some more, they would have more energy
yeah,
from that.
Yeah, yeah.
That was 20 years ago, Anders.
20 years ago.
And now they are like still seeking for the Holy Grail to turn these industrial areas around the cities into zero emission and zero waste places. So they have to go to Sweden.
Yeah, if they want to see such a building, so it's easier to go there and look around.
It's amazing that these examples are there out there
yeah,
in the world.
Yeah.
You just need to know where to look. Mm.
And also I can mention the Lagerberg school outside Sundsvall, where the whole school is eco-cycle adapted, and they are using the school as a part of the education of the children in the school. I think mm-hmm. this is also a very good idea.
So
a school,
the building is the teaching for the children
yeah, yeah,
what they
in,
learn.
In sustainability. Yeah.
Okay.
So they have all these installations also that we are done. And we made it, it's more than 25 years ago now.
I'm just nodding my head like, oh man, if people would just know where to find for this and just use your common sense, then things could be so much
yes.
healthier for everybody.
Yeah. And I think that's the reason why we need to show good examples. And we have tried to do it with the project we have done, but it's not easy to convince people, for they are... They have not the overall view of the projects.
Mm-hmm.
For people in such a project, they are educated to take care of a small piece of the project.
Yeah.
But very few people have an overall view of the system. For this is typical system design, when you're thinking that a part of the construction is a part of the energy system. If you choose the right material, you have also solved the problem about energy, for example.
So basically, the two thoughts are coming up to me, Anders. One of them is, I tend to have the idea that architects are the very few systems thinkers in society, and they have a sort of a role to play in here.
Mm.
And on the other side, the way you approach a project, as you mentioned, first you teach and then you go through the social, ecology, technical, and the economic. I've been talking to some construction companies, and you mentioned they're only working on one part of the whole building.
Mm-hmm.
And when I show them, if you put all the different parts together, your business model, your business case, or your business proposition changes completely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because the service you offer are part of a bigger chain or a bigger system. Those are the two reflections I have. What I found interesting, what would be your advice as an architect with a systems thinking mind to construction companies?
I think it's very important, as we did in the Green Zone project in Umeå in Sweden. We were sitting together with the client, with all those who are involved in the building concept from the very beginning. We were writing the program together. So
mm-hmm.
the construction people, the HVAC people, the electricians, the people working with the green areas around the building, everybody was sitting, one person around the table. And we are have an open discussion. What can we do together with the experience? Normally, when you make a project in Holland or Sweden, you point out an architect and he makes the design. Then people from the construction company said that it should be steel or concrete or whatever in the construction. And then you have the HVAC people saying that we need our big installations in the roof and the ceiling is lower and lower depending on how big
the ventilation system is.
And then you have the electricians at the end making all the wires in the building. But we are sitting down together with everybody from the very beginning. And when we are discussing, so they can say, I have been doing a project earlier that we did and that, and it was a good example that we could cooperate. So this is also a sort of system thinking when you connect people with each other early in a...
And then
you shall also take the responsibility. And today, very few architects are taking care of the buildings when it's finished. We are always going to our project every year to see what's working, what's not working, what can we learn from earlier projects. And I think we have a lot of things to learn from what we have done, but also what we can learn from already built buildings. I think the old buildings in the Western society have a lot of things to teach us. So the buildings we can see in a society, though, we say they are beautiful and so on, and I think they are still there and in use, depending on they have a quality.
Yeah.
They have good materials, they have the functional lifespan, and they have all the positive things that we can still use them and reuse them. And all bad buildings are taken down.
Yeah.
So what we see is the best buildings, and we have to protect them and learn from them.
Yeah, it's an interesting paradox, Anders. When everybody likes the old cities because of the arguments you're giving.
Yeah.
And yet we live in all these suburbs which are all mechanized and technical, and the soul of the building is gone.
Yeah.
That's why I like old buildings, because you can feel there is life in the building.
I used to say that the modern blocks of flats is a storage for people during the night. You go into the entrance and take the elevator, go into your flat, lock it with the security locks, and then you are living there as in a prison. People who are living in such buildings, they don't know their neighbors.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah,
and we have tried to build other type of block of flats. We have one up in Umeå, where we have a green room in the middle of the building, and its balconies on both sides of the green room. And when people come into the building, then they are at home. And then they walk up to their balcony.
Balcony inside or
inside,
outside?
Inside, yeah.
Ah, okay.
Yeah. And then they take off their shoes on the balcony, and they open the door and leave it open. It means I'm at home. Do you want to take contact with me? Do that. And they have a private balcony close to the entrance door. So they in the evenings, they can sit. I've been living in that house. Then you can talk with another family in the basement and ask them, what have they done today, and so on. And I have also seen that people in that building helping each other. So young families ask the old people living in the house, I'm going to the grocery shop. Do you need something? I can buy it for you if you take care of my children.
You know how that sounds, Anders? Like people are always on holidays.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's holiday inside your own city.
Yeah. And if you have this green room in the middle of the house and living close to the Arctic Circle, you have still a vision of a beautiful summer day when you are sitting together with your neighbors with the palm trees or whatever you have around you.
And palm trees inside of the building.
Up
north in Sweden.
Yeah, yeah.
You can grow palm trees.
Yeah, yeah.
So we can have our own gardens.
Yeah.
Gardens of Eden.
And you can also grow food. So the next vision we have for this type of buildings is to grow food inside that building. And with aquaponic, you can also grow fish and fresh and vegetables in that green room. At the same is a relaxed room for those who are living in the building.
Yeah, I think we had earlier, we had Niklas Wenberg in the podcast, and he explained me that he now has two projects from Municipality of Gutenberg and Malmö to actually integrate his systems in a local building block.
But if you build it, so you also help people to live in a different way. The social vision for the way you are living. It's not a storage of people.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a way of living together.
So if you mention storage of people, and I'm just thinking also about my conversations with local governments, especially social housing, they have a target, they have a number of houses, and basically they think in storage of people. That's sort of that's business
that's
model.
So just now I'm also involved in a project which is, I think it's very interesting. It's to build together with refugees, let them be introduced in the Swedish society by building their own houses so they can live cheaper in their own houses. So they can be proud of, I coming to a new country, I have learned the building technology in the country, and I live in my own small house. And this is a totally different way to integrate refugees. We tried it in Holland also, but they haven't continued to do it. I have now done a project in Sweden that we hopefully can see a result within a couple of years.
Yeah, your colleague Walter Stahl, he's a professor in Switzerland, and he's the promoter of the performance economy, and his vision is to own nothing. And I'm living in Rotterdam in an area where you have a lot of people are not originally coming from the Netherlands, and they are proud to own something because if you're an immigrant, creating value for yourself and your community is so important. So it's an interesting contradiction that on one side the performance economy of the people who say ownership doesn't exist, we hire and rent everything. On the other side, owning something has also to do with a lot of pride and aspirations.
But you can also be proud of being involved in a project where you are living. So what we are talking about is tiny houses, really small areas. And for example, in Sweden nowadays, a lot of young people, they are standing out of the common market for flats. They haven't enough of money to buy their flats. And we made the calculations for this project. So if two students work 8 hours per day, they can build their own house within 2 months. And they have the monthly cost is only 20% of an ordinary flat in the Swedish society. 20%, it's so cheap. For example, my office, it's...
Which one?
The one up in Sundsvall, the earth-covered house. It's 125 square meter.
Yeah.
And the cost per month is one-third of a student's flat in Sweden.
I think a lot of professionals will then have your house as an office. Cheap office space.
it's a cheap way. But I have done it myself. Yeah. I built it myself. And I think if we can build our village, Rumpan village, with amateurs, it's possible to train students to build their students' flats in one stored building in a small building and make it in a very, very good way.
And then I certainly hear sort of like one of my listeners, what about regulations, building regulations?
Yeah, why not? We shall follow the regulations, but if we build it's better than they usually do, we are talking about passive housing.
Okay.
Houses without a need of electricity.
Oh, that sounds
really... And with their own wastewater treatment, biological wastewater treatment. We don't need any connection to the wastewater connections. And for example, here in Holland, you have problem with the water. You have problem with leaking wastewater treatment pipes. And they are polluting the water table.
Yeah.
And you have salt coming in from the ocean to your water table. So you have really problem with the water. So if you can have totally different toilet system, we now talking about ordinary toilets and so on, but mm-hmm. biological cleaning, so you can reuse the water. We designed a project in China where we also use the roof of the small buildings as a cleaning place for the wastewater. We pump it up, the black water or the gray water, and then we clean it in with the flowers and...
So you have and then, plants, yeah?
And then we could reuse the water for flushing the toilets. So we have a closed system.
It's that easy.
Yeah, very easy. And beautiful.
Yeah, green roofs are always beautiful.
Yeah.
That's something we are missing in a lot of cities.
Yeah.
Anders, this is, I'm getting goosebumps. This is another conversation about common sense and creativity and don't think in, what they say? Don't think in problems.
Solutions. Think in possibilities.
Think in possibilities and don't let yourself down that things cannot be done. Because I think you've now given like 5 or 6 examples. The last one I like. Because that would turn the building industry completely upside down. Mm-hmm. Suddenly we have plants which bring back the water cycle on the cities, and we have more respiration of the plants and more oxygen.
Yeah.
I only see plus.
Mm-hmm.
But it's
and common sense.
And common sense, yeah, and common sense, and it's. As you said, education, if you know where to look for this information, you know that it exists, and then you have the examples. Mm. Every time I close these always inspiring sessions with the question, what kind of suggestions would you have for my listeners where they can look up more information on the mindset you're providing, on YouTube movies or books they should read?
I think there are so many good examples spread all over the world. So you can find the good examples everywhere. But it's easier to talk about the bad things and the problems in the future. But we need to focus on the positive things, the good examples. And they are all over the world. And you can also go back to the... really old societies where you can find people living in close connection to nature, and they survive and had a happy life and have time to live.
Yeah, I'm smiling while you're saying that, Anders. There was a research I done on passive building, but also on clay is a very good insulator, and I discovered that in Persia they were already making ice in the desert, which was pure physics, logic, and these houses were 21, 22 degrees inside, where it was on the outside 40 degrees.
Yeah, and also you can go back to the pharaohs' time, where they have thermite ventilation, that dig down in the soil and use the cooling from that. And this is what they have been doing for thousands of years in the Arab countries also. And now we think that this is unique, but it's common sense.
Common sense. Yes. Now, so much. Thank you, Anders, for having you on the show today. And I'm getting goosebumps because I've learned again so much because of listening to you and having all these examples. So thank you again for that. Now, this was it. Join me for next time on a new Masters of Beautiful Achievements. Until then.